When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Hi everyone, it's Kevin G, the best thing since summer. And you're listening to The Therapy Suite right here on UK Health Radio, the world's number one talk health radio. This week, I speak to Matt Armour about his experiences with myocarditis. Welcome to the show, Matt. How are you doing?
Hi, Kevin. Yeah, I'm very well, thank you. Yeah, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. Thank you for your time today. Much appreciated. Matt, talk to us a bit about your background and before the diagnosis of myocarditis. Is that okay?
Yeah, that's fine. So prior to sort of being diagnosed with myocarditis or having any related issues, I was actually a very keen sportsman, keen cyclist predominantly. So I was doing, I was sort of racing at amateur level, but quite high amateur level, doing sort of 100 mile plus bicycle races, road races. So super fit as far as I was concerned. I used to do a bit of running as well, and anything I could really to keep myself fit and healthy. Always sort of tried to eat the right things, and just generally, yeah, very fit and healthy. And this was right the way through from my sort of mid-teens up to my late 20s when obviously everything happened. So so yeah, very fit and healthy person.
And how old was you when you received the diagnosis?
So I received the diagnosis when I was 28. So, yeah, late 20s. Yeah.
What were some of the symptoms that started to initially show well before you got the diagnosis?
So when I talk about my symptoms, I have to really talk about them in hindsight, because what happened in my case was I ended up having an out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, and then going on, obviously going into hospital, having a battery of tests, an angiogram, an MRI, echocardiogram, all those sort of tests, which determined that I had probably, you know, they were 95% sure that I'd suffered from viral myocarditis, and that was the cause. And then when they sort of asked me, retrospectively what I experienced in the run up to having this cardiac arrest, they asked me about fatigue. And they asked me about sort of palpitations and pains in my chest and things like that. None of which I really had on a day-to-day basis, doing sort of day-to-day tasks. For me, the thing as an athlete that really gave away something was wrong, was the fact that I was struggling on the bike, more than anything. So I was really gauging my performance on the bike as that was the sort of the telltale sign something was wrong. So that to me, in hindsight, not that I really put two and two together at the time, because I just thought in fact, my reaction was, I'm not going very well on the bike. I need to train harder. So I was doing totally the wrong thing by my body. Because, of course, with myocarditis, if you're diagnosed with it, the main thing is rest. And I was doing the opposite, sadly. But I just, I mean, I'd never heard of it before I was told about it. I didn't even know it was a thing. So I just thought, well, I'm having a bad year. And I need to train harder. And that was my response. So,
yeah. So afterwards, after some of those symptoms, you were kind of, obviously, because you didn't know exactly what was going on, you were thinking, if you just improve your health even more so, it might help, basically. But actually, that in hindsight now, you're thinking, actually, that might not have been the best way forwards.
That's it. Yeah, no, that's it, sadly. I think, obviously, there would have been a point where I had sort of non-acute myocarditis, which probably could have been resolved. But I was just unaware, you know, that's the nefarious thing about the condition. I was totally unaware I had it. I was used to feeling tired to some, you know, respect, because obviously being an athlete, doing lots of training, you come home, you're tired at the end of the day, you know, you've done a 50 or 60 mile bike ride, you've done this, you've done that, you've done this race. So you're used to feeling tired. I think in hindsight, I was a lot more tired than I should have been. And realistically, there weren't too many other symptoms. I mean, I did suffer from some dizziness, more towards sort of the end of, towards when I had the cardiac arrest. But again, because it was summertime, it was hot, I put it down to dehydration. You know, I put it down to, having a day at work and then going out for a training ride, possibly not drinking enough, not eating enough, something like that. You know, it was, I certainly, you know, I never thought the worst. I've never been a hypochondriac or anything like that. It's never been like, oh, you know, something could be really wrong. If anything, it was always the opposite. It was just a case of, well, you know, carry on through it, get it done. Can't miss training, got to keep training. And off I went, sort of thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. I totally empathize with you. You know, I think anyone could easily miss what was going on and put it down to other factors, you know?
Yeah, that's it.
When the diagnosis came through, how did it make you feel? What did you go through?
As I say, I found out once I was in hospital, and once I'd sort of come around from the cardiac arrest, and they basically put me into an induced coma. They obviously, you know, pumped me full of a lot of drugs to reduce the arrhythmia that was being caused. And they did tests such as I say, they did the angiogram, MRI scan. And I think it was the MRI scan where they could really see the heart, you know, in its 3D form and sort of what had happened to it. And they saw that it was massively enlarged and that it had suffered a lot of scarring as a result of obviously the infection that got into it. They were quite good in that they sort of they obviously broke it to me. They had to break it to you like it is. So they told me I had myocarditis and they explained a bit about it. They didn't say too much about its various forms in terms of obviously, you know, it obviously becomes acute over time. And they spared me at that point. They spared me the fact that obviously if they'd caught it earlier, it could have been treated. But obviously I found that out later once I started doing some research. So obviously I was in hospital for a few weeks after that. And I was doing, you know, I did some reading about it, and I sort of, the more I read, the more I discovered that obviously if I had known about it sooner, or I had more sort of, palpable, symptoms, then I could have maybe done something about it and saved myself, A, the cardiac arrest, and B, you know, what I've been through in the last 10 years, which obviously we can discuss a bit later. But it was obviously, you're very happy to have, you know, come through and survived and out of hospital cardiac arrest, which of course is quite a rare thing in itself. But also tinged with sort of like, I guess a bit of sadness and disappointment, you know, that I hadn't picked it up sooner, that I hadn't noticed something was wrong, that I hadn't been a bit more persistent maybe with like, you know, with GPs and things like that. Because I had been, you know, I had been to the GP and mentioned that I wasn't feeling quite right, but I'd obviously done it all from the aspect of being an athlete and the cycling, and I don't feel quite right on my bike, you know. And of course, they take one look at you and say, well, you're a fit, healthy 28-year-old. There's nothing wrong with you. So, mixed emotions.
Was there any support for you for your mental well-being at all?
There wasn't anything offered to me directly NHS-wise. I did. I instigated a couple of different counsellors through friends that I sort of knew of that that were a big help. I got one through a place I worked at initially after the cardiac arrest when I felt well enough to go back to work. They were good enough to provide me with some counselling, and then another one was for a friend, it definitely helped. So whether it's available on the NHS or not, I think it tends to be one of those things you have to really push for if you're going to get it through the NHS. So again, it was easier and quicker to do it down the sort of private route. So yeah, I did have some help, and it certainly did help. But what I do find sometimes about that sort of thing is, because it's so specific, when you talk to someone who hasn't been through it, it is quite hard for them to like totally understand and totally empathize with what you're going through. So, but it's always good to talk to someone about it.
Did you talk to friends and family about it as well?
Yeah, my friends and family have always been really good, particularly my family. My brother, I was sort of living with him at the time of the time it all happened. We sort of shared a house, and so when I came out of hospital, sadly that wasn't the end of it. They fitted me with a subcutaneous ICD, which is an internal defibrillator, which is obviously constantly monitoring your heart rhythm, and if you go into any dangerous rhythms, it gives you a shock, an electrical shock, to sort of reset your heart. And within about 2 weeks of coming out of hospital, I was experiencing the joys of that. So I was back in hospital again quite a bit, to be honest, over the first year, you know, afterwards. With shocks, and obviously they were constantly tweaking medications and things like that. That continued the whole saga, if you like, because the myocarditis obviously caused it, but the myocarditis went away. But because the heart doesn't repair itself like other muscles do, I was left with the resultant damage of the myocarditis, which obviously caused, you know, further problems. I definitely need to lean on, you know, support of family. I mean, I couldn't drive, you know, for a long time. So it makes you the mobility very hard. And I try to keep as normal life as possible, but it obviously is hard. And it is hard mentally, because you feel like you can't trust your body. Once you know there's something literally inside you monitoring, making sure you stay alive, you know, it's quite hard then to go out and act and be as normal. So, difficult.
Of course. Do you still have the device installed in you?
No, so I don't now. They also said to me that I was in heart failure. That was something they mentioned when I sort of came around, and they told me what happened. They told me about myocarditis, and they told me that my actual heart function was quite severely reduced in terms of what it should be. And I didn't really pay too much attention to that initially, because I actually felt pretty well, all things considered. I still felt quite physically well. I was still doing a lot of walking. It was more the arrhythmia side of things, the shocks, you know, that would come and go. You know, I'd have bouts of of shocks, particularly around stressful times. So the heart failure thing was always like, okay, it's on all my letters, it's on all my hospital letters that I've been diagnosed with heart failure, but it never really worried me too much. It was always something I thought would, I hoped would kind of plateau or stabilize and I'd just be okay, you know, and I'd live with the device and that, and I'd get the occasional shock and that would be fine. As it happened, the heart function was actually deteriorating, gradually throughout the past 9 years. So more recently, this year, I was told that I'd gone into advanced heart failure. So my pumping function had gone right the way down, which I was definitely feeling because I was really struggling to do a lot. You know, walking was becoming more difficult, and I just felt generally just more and more unwell, more and more fatigued. I was getting more and more arrhythmia, lots of shocks. And then it all came to a head at the end of May this year when I had another cardiac arrest that the device couldn't cope with. It kept shocking me repeatedly, but they couldn't get me out of the rhythm because my heart was so badly damaged. So I required CPR, which fortunately my dad was around to administer. And again, rushed to what I say is my hospital, which is the John Radcliffe, who are the guys that looked after me from the very beginning. They've been fantastic throughout, and they stabilised me enough to be transferred to the Queen Elizabeth in Birmingham, where I received a heart transplant on the 27th of June. So that's a long-rounded way of answering your question, because they took out my ICD because it's no longer required, because obviously I've got a new heart now. So it's kind of the end of the story insofar as the myocarditis and the arrhythmia side of things are concerned. So it's a bit of a new start now.
Brilliant.
Which is not,
fantastic. We're just going to a quick break and we'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
So Matt, thank you very much for that introduction into your experiences with myocarditis. Can you take us back a little bit and talk to us about the journey of your diagnosis and how long it took to get to that point, what the process was and that kind of thing?
So as I mentioned before, the diagnosis for me was obviously as an inpatient in hospital following the cardiac arrest. So I remember the bits and pieces from the day of the cardiac arrest. I was actually out on my bike with my friends at the time, fortunately, because they were really good and they basically helped save my life. And it just so happened that when I had the cardiac arrest in earnest, I was near a cricket pitch where they were playing cricket at the time. Two of the guys playing were lifeguards, so they hopped the wall and started administering CPR straight away. I had a doctor happen to drive past and stopped and was sort of directing everyone and getting everyone doing the right thing. The fire brigade were there within 3 minutes with a defibrillator. So I was very, very lucky. And I was also quite close to the John Radcliffe Hospital. But, of course, no one knew what happened and why. So I got bundled into an ambulance and off to the hospital. And no one knew, what was going to be the outcome. And as I say, it took them, obviously, once they stabilised me, it took them, I was in there a good couple of weeks, and it took them sort of 10 days to find out exactly what happened. They did an angiogram to check that it wasn't, thrombosis related. I didn't have a blocked artery or something like that, which they ruled out. They said everything was very, very clear and healthy in that respect. And so I think it was when they did the echocardiogram And the MRI that they were able to discover that the heart was enlarged due to scarring and inflammation. And that's generally down usually to one thing in a case of someone like myself, which would be a viral infection. That's when they informed me that the highly likely cause of my cardiac arrest was viral myocarditis. So yeah, that was sort of the journey to it. Along with obviously the retrospective look at the symptoms I had that I'd mentioned earlier.
How long did it take to get to the diagnosis point from when you first started having symptoms?
So realistically that would have been quite a long time because I was struggling even as far back as earlier that year. So this was 2016, July 2016, end of July, that I had the cardiac arrest. But I would say even as far back as sort of January, February, I wasn't cycling so much at that point because it's like off season for cycling. But I was doing a bit of running, and I remember obviously running is quite, you know, I've gone and run, but I've run sort of short distances at quite an intense pace. And I remember just on certain runs, just, you know, feeling really dizzy all of a sudden and having to literally, you know, steady myself against a wall or a tree, feeling like I was going to black out, you know, and I wouldn't, but I'd catch my breath and I'd carry on and sort of be okay and wonder what on earth was going on. But again, wasn't worried enough to sort of do anything about it. I just assumed that it was like I'm doing a different sort of exercise I'm not used to, you know. Again, might be a bit dehydrated. You know, get home, have a good drink, make sure I, you know, do that. And but I feel like now looking back, it probably is all related. I think it has to be. The closer I got to the event, the more sort of things, I guess, leap out at me in terms of, well, this was definitely related. I went with my friends to Spain in March to do some like winter training in a warmer climate. And normally that's like my bread and butter. It's long distances over like mountainous terrain. It's what I really enjoyed. And I struggled so much on that training camp. You know, I couldn't keep up with my friends. We were doing big mileage days, you know, over 100 miles, and I was having to duck out of some of the rides and go back to where we were staying because I was just so tired. You know, I couldn't hold a candle to any of them. Which again, at that point in time, I was thinking, well, I'm just not going very well. I was trying to force myself out to go out every day, even though I didn't feel like doing it. I just wanted to lie in bed, really. But yeah, so I was doing the wrong thing, but not knowing quite how wrong it was, you know. And then closer again, and I mean much closer, to the event, to the cardiac arrest, which I had on a Saturday. On the Thursday, I went out with a friend, again on the bike, just for a sort of like after work, you know, training ride, or chat ride, really. But he says to me, "Oh, I'm going to do an effort up this certain road." And I said, "Well, I don't feel great, so I'll just try and sit on your wheel because it's easier if you follow a wheel because you don't get so much wind pushing you back." So I quickly, you know, whereas normally that should be quite easy for someone with good fitness just to sit on a wheel and follow someone up a hill, I couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it. He quickly like went off up the road. I got to the top of this hill and promptly blacked out and woke up in the road with a car behind me, wondering why there was a cyclist sprawled out in the road. I completely cracked my helmet in two. I torn up all the left side of my body. Everything was bleeding. And I sort of wake up just thinking, well, what on earth happened? And I picked myself back up and gingerly got back on the bike, by which point my friend had got all the way up to do his effort and was at a turn around because he wondered where I was. And of course, he took one look at me and said, what's happened? And I said, well, I just blacked out. And he was worried. He said, "Well, you need to go to the doctors. That's weird." And I said, "Oh, I think I'm just dehydrated, but I will book an appointment for Monday." You know, and of course, Monday, you know, was too late because obviously it all happened on Saturday. But when I told the doctors about that, they sort of and said that was in all likelihood an aborted cardiac arrest. And at that point, we were in the middle of nowhere. You know, and if it happened in earnest then that probably would have been a different story, to be honest. So I was very lucky. So yeah.
Was it also, I can imagine, it must have been, was it affecting your daily routine in work as well?
Yeah. So, yeah, I was working. Yeah, I was doing quite a physical job at the time because I was actually working for a florist they used to deliver to a lot of hotels in the area. So I was like doing their deliveries essentially, but in like big made up sort of stone vases and stuff. So it was actually quite a physical job. So I was doing that too, on top of everything else and on top of all the cycling. So there was that on top. So I do a full physical day at work and then, you know, go out and train in the evening. So, you know, it's one of those double-edged things because I feel like I pushed myself probably to the point where I potentially made myself ill and then ignored some of the signs because I'm like, well, I'm just tired because I'm doing a lot. But equally, I think my fitness probably did help save me as well. And the doctors also said that. They said if you hadn't been as physically fit as you were, it probably would have been a different story. So it's one of those, you know, it's very much a double-edged sword.
Of course. We're just going to a quick ad break and we'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
So Matt, thank you so much for, you know, talking to us about your journey with myocarditis. I know you mentioned about having the device, the defibrillator, is that right?
That's right, yeah.
Except for that, was there any other treatment that was tried or anything else that was trialled?
So I had the device fitted, obviously, and that was a life-saving device, you know, in case of that's the last resort device that would fire if I went into VET, which is ventricular tachycardia, which is essentially the rhythm that you get prior to ventricular fibrillation, which essentially then is like your heart just stopping. So it would shock at I think 240 beats a minute, which is obviously very, very high. So it'd wait until the heart got to that point before it would do anything about it. So as you can imagine, if you're sat there having not been doing a lot, but you're at 200 beats and you can feel that something's wrong in your chest, that's quite a scary experience because you sort of know you're going to get therapy or you know you're looking at, you know, towards getting the therapy, but you're not sure which way it's going to go because sometimes it would self-terminate and other times it would give you a shock. But I was there for that reason. And then there was obviously all the medication as well. So over the years, I think I tried pretty much every antiarrhythmia medication that was on offer. So to begin with, it was very much an antiarrhythmia thing with the medication. So you're talking some quite potent medications such as like amiodarone, which is a really, really good antiarrhythmia medication, but it has quite a few side effects in terms of particularly like photosensitivity and things like that. So I was having to be really careful in the sun. It affects your eyes and things like that. So a lot of the drugs, yeah, they do sort of make you feel pretty tired. So that took some getting used to. So yeah, and then obviously in the latter stages, they put me onto some to some heart failure drugs as well, which obviously were just designed to keep the pumping function up as much as possible. So, yeah, medication-wise, I was always on probably at least 3 or 4, but sometimes up to sort of 6 or 7 medications, you know, at any one time. So,
yeah. Did the medication have symptoms as well?
Some of them did. Yeah, so I was on another one called Sotalol, which again is another good. It's a beta blocker, I believe, but with sort of anti-arrhythmia effects as well. But that in itself can cause other conditions such as long QT syndrome. So they monitor you very closely in the early stage of taking that particular drug, with blood tests to make sure, and ECGs to make sure that you're not at risk of developing long QT syndrome, which again can be a fatal condition. So yeah, they do have, in fact, most of the drugs on the side effects would say can cause arrhythmia. So they're protecting against arrhythmia, but at the same time, they can cause it. What they did do, predominantly a lot of these drugs, was bring my heart rate right down. So I had a resting heart rate of something like 42 to 45 beats a minute. And my blood pressure was incredibly low as well. So you'd be looking at something like 89 over 60 or something like that, you know, which is very much on the low side. So it, you know, it really kept everything sort of on the low side and controlled that way. But of course, that doesn't make you feel great in itself, because you're lacking energy, you know, you get up and you feel dizzy because you have blood pressures low. So there were quite a few side effects, but they were side effects that I got used to and sort of agreed to live with and accepted, because it was kind of like, well, they're keeping the arrhythmia at bay, so that's what I need. So,
and you mentioned earlier that this year you've had a heart transplant. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Are you on medication despite that still, because of what happened?
Yeah, very much so. If anything, I'm actually on more medication now than I was. Yeah. So I didn't realise this going into it, but with any form of transplant, it's obviously a procedure that you have that gives you a much better quality of life, because I'm not worried about arrhythmia anymore. I can go to bed, sleep at night, and not worry about my heart or some device keeping me alive. But it's not a cure. It's it still requires a lot of hospital intervention. It requires a lot of medication. So the primary medications I'm on now are for anti-rejection, because when you get a transplant of any type, the body will try to reject any organ. So I want some pretty hefty anti-rejection medications, which primarily what they do is obviously they immunosuppress you. So you know, to the point where your body doesn't reject the new organ. So that in itself obviously has its dangers, because you're more prone to infection, you're more prone to illnesses and things like that. So I've had to be very careful cutting out. There's like a whole list of foods that I can't eat, such as shellfish and things like that, because of the bacteria risk. So it's quite an undertaking. And when they brought around the medications for me to do for the first time in hospital, you know, you get a little book and everything, and they're at 5 different time slots in the day, and you have to take this medication then and that medication then, and make sure you take certain medications 12 hours apart. And it's all very to the letter and very scientifically worked out. And they will up and down titrate the meds depending on blood tests and biopsy results and things like that. So I'm still very much within the medical sphere, let's put it that way. It's not just off you go now, you're fixed, you know. But quality of life wise, I say I'm only sort of you know, well, it's 27th of June, so yeah, three months ish after transplant. So it's still sort of early days, and it's still learning the routine. And recovering really, because obviously you don't fully recover from that sort of surgery for quite a while. So, but I could definitely see a brighter future in terms of the one that I was living before. So.
Over time, will the medication, because obviously it's a very recent transition, have doctors advise what's going to happen over the long term in terms of medication? I'm guessing because your body is at the moment accepting the new heart, this is just possibly, is this something just in the interim, maybe the next 1-2 years, or is this something ongoing with medication?
So some of the medications will be ongoing. I'm on actually sort of 12 different medications at the moment. Roughly half of those, I think, could disappear in time. But the main ones, which are tacrolimus and MNF, which is mycophenolate, they're the two anti-rejection ones. And I'll be on those for life, because obviously they protect you from rejection, and that risk never goes away, no matter how long you've had the heart. I mean, I spoke to someone at a recent clinic visit who had a heart transplant 21 years ago, and sort of, you know, a dab hand at everything and knew exactly what they were doing. And I think they were down to like the bare minimum of meds that they could be on, but they would never take you off those, because, as I say, the risk of rejection, the body rejecting the heart, never goes away. But that, to me, you know, is not a big deal, because I was on all these antiarrhythmia meds anyway, which I would have been even if the heart failure had plateaued, the arrhythmia would have stayed. So I would have been on those medications for life anyway. So I kind of accepted that. So it was easier for me to accept being on these new meds for life, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah. And since having the procedure, how's life changed? Have you seen more of the positive side of things in terms of maybe work or your maybe exercise regime, or has anything changed in that, like that? I know it's only been very recently, but have you seen any changes?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's definitely helped me mentally. I think, because again, looking back, not that you really realise it at the time particularly, because it just becomes your daily life and you just live with it, but I think I realized how, maybe subconsciously, but how just fearful I was of like what's the next day going to bring, you know, in terms of the arrhythmia and the heart condition, and, you know, am I going to get a shock tomorrow? You know, is something going to go wrong? Can I, you know, you'll get like an invitation to go somewhere and do something. Well, is that something I can manage or not? And I was always quite good at, you know, I did a lot when I had the arrhythmia. You know, I climbed Snowdon a couple of times. You know, I went to weddings, I went to funerals. I tried to go to things, but there were certain things that I didn't go to. Like, I've got a friend who lives in America. He invited me to his wedding, and I was just like, I can't risk it. I can't risk the flying. I can't risk being in America with how it is over there. And so I had to, you know, the various things I had to just concede defeat to, you know, in terms of my health, you know, because that was just how it was. So whereas now, I've already got a few little trips booked, albeit sort of within the UK, but you know, a little bit further afield, which is really nice, really positive, and something that I haven't really done for a while. And then because there's a whole team behind you when you have a transplant, so refer to them as the transplant team. And once they sign me off to fly, you know, it'll be a case of like maybe going on holiday somewhere, again, reasonably localish, but you know, somewhere with a bit of sunshine maybe, and you know, so there's lots to like look forward to now that I perhaps wouldn't have been able to look forward to, you know, where I was a few months ago, certainly. So that's really positive. In terms of work, I haven't been back to work yet. Again, I need to be sort of medically signed off in order to do that. But that's due to come up quite soon. So that's another positive step. You know, it's all sort of progressing quite nicely as well as it can do, because people do, you know, some patients do have quite a few issues off the back of transplantation. It's not as simple as just taking out an organ and putting a new one in, you know, it can lead to a whole raft of other issues. And the other organs can be affected, particularly the kidneys. So a lot of transplant patients end up on dialysis quite some time as well. And in obviously very severe cases, it can lead to the shutdown of other organs as well. So in my case, I've been very lucky to avoid that. So I'm just trying to sort of stay as positive as possible and do as much as I can within the limits I've got at the moment. So
absolutely. Yeah. If there's someone that's newly diagnosed with myocarditis, what advice would you want to share with them?
For someone newly diagnosed, I would, I would hope that they've been diagnosed early, in which case it's not acute myocarditis and it's certainly not, you know, a death sentence. It can be very easily treated with rest and treatment from the hospital. So it's one of those conditions that, albeit it's hard to spot, I think. If someone's diagnosed and it is spotted early and treated early, then you can fully recover. So my advice would be very positive and take the advice from doctors. I think it does seem to the common denominator does seem to be young athletic people, and I think those people probably are some of the worst that perhaps. You know, taking the advice that they've got to rest. But I would say definitely do that and get yourself better. And then you'll be able to sort of carry on. I wish I'd known more about it. I really do. I wish I'd known enough to be able to say to myself, well, there's definitely something wrong here. I need to get myself to A&E or whatever and get some tests done. I just didn't know about it. So, to anyone who gets diagnosed, it's a good thing. You know, it's a good thing that you've been diagnosed and you can be treated for it. And don't you know, fret about it. And again, for someone who has to go down, goes down the route that I did in and gets acute myocarditis, and then you know, it's a bit more than how long is a piece of string in terms of what your symptoms thereafter are going to be. I mean, obviously mine were quite extreme with the arrhythmia and the needing an ICD, but again, it won't be the same for everyone. So, you know, again, it's kind of, there's so much they can do, you know, there's so much they can do. And it was a case of, I was very lucky with, let's say the John Radcliffe Hospital in terms of, the care I received and the doctors that treated me. And we always had a good dialogue, and always explained what they were going to do and why. And they always gave me, in a lot of respects, they gave me sort of multiple options in terms of like the treatment that I could receive. I had a couple of ablations in that time period, over the last 9 years, which is when they sort of go in through an artery and they actually, it sounds awful, but they sort of, cauterize bits of the heart they map the electrical impulses in the heart. And they try and spot where the arrhythmia is coming from. They try and cauterize those pockets of trouble. I had a couple of those. So there's so much they can do to try and reduce any sort of arrhythmia that comes off the back of myocarditis as well. So it's very much something you can sort of pull through and continue to live, you know, a normal life with.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you very much. We've come to the end. Would it be okay if people wanted to reach out for you to find out more about myocarditis or just have a chat? Would that be okay?
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I'd welcome that from anyone. Yeah, anyone going through it or any family members that want to discuss it. Then absolutely. Yeah, very happy to talk to anyone about it. Yeah.
What's the best way to get in contact with you?
Probably via email or mobile phone. Yeah, either way.
What's your, I suppose not numbers, but if you drop us your email or social media,
Social media would also work. Yeah. I give you a few my different details. Yeah, that's fine. Yeah.
If you can say your Instagram social media right now, that'd be brilliant, if that's okay.
So I am Matty Ulmer at on Instagram. So MattyUllmer.
Brilliant. And Matt, thank you for coming to the show today. I really appreciate the information and, you know, you sharing about what you went through and how you've come through the other end. That's brilliant. Thank you very much.
No problem, Gavin. Thanks. My pleasure.
And thank you to our listeners. You know, you can find me on Instagram at GavinJ417. Until next time, take care.